You are listening to the cycling podcast Brevet, in association with Rafa.
Hello, my name is Lionel Burney and you are listening to a special and somewhat different episode of the cycling podcast, which we're choosing to call the cycling podcast Brevet. At the moment, this is a one-off episode, but it may prove to be a pilot for a longer series because it covers an area of the sport that is massively growing, but which we don't talk about in our regular episodes, and that's endurance and ultra-endurance cycling. With events such as the Transcontinental Race capturing the imagination, it's a discipline that combines adventure with racing. It's competitive, but there's also a spirit of exploration, as well as a sense of community and camaraderie that might sometimes be missing from professional racing. This episode features a conversation between Richard Moore and Mark Beaumont, who recently smashed the round-the-world record, averaging 240 miles a day. That's right, 240 miles a day, as he circumnavigated the globe by bike in just 78 days. Not even Phileas Fogg could imagine that. So it seemed appropriate that they met at the Reform Club in London.
So, yeah, well, Mark, where are we exactly?
We are in the Reform Club. There's some very serious-looking gentlemen peering down on us from some pretty ancient paintings, and a lovely sort of deep red wallpaper. It's a place with amazing history. I wanted to come back here because, of course, this is where the fiction started in terms of Jules Verne, Phileas Fogg, Around the World in 80 Days, 1873. I wonder what the Victorians would make of the idea of actually getting around the world under your own power in 80 days. So I kind of wanted to come back and chat to the members, meet the Reform Club crew.
And Michael Palin tried to do this same thing after his similar journey, but wasn't allowed in because he wasn't wearing a shirt and tie.
Ah, that's right. So he tried to, because I think he got around the world in 79 days and X amount of hours. And that's right. They didn't let him in.
I think he did his talk on the steps.
Well, you're looking pretty dapper yourself.
Well,
today.
Thank you, Mark. So are you. You scrubbed up well from. I mean, you've been back a few weeks now.
Yeah, I literally finished a fortnight ago.
How are you? Because I spoke to you after your last round the world record. You know, in the aftermath of that, I had the sense watching the interviews, reading the interviews as well after this one, that it really. It took a far greater toll, and you seemed almost kind of traumatized by it. Is that there was an interview in the Sunday Times in particular, which I thought that came across quite strongly.
Yes and no. I mean, ten years ago when I cycled around the world, it was unsupported. It was touring style. I rode a century a day for half a year, and given my experience at the time, you know, post university, it was incredibly difficult. You know, I finished and. What definitely took a while to readjust physically and probably more than anything else, just psychologically. I'd been out there on my own for half a year. What I've just done makes 10 years ago look like, you know, kindergarten because, you know, I was riding 240 miles a day for 78 days and 14 hours. In terms of, it was no longer wild man style. It was purely, you know, an athletic endeavor. It was absolutely 100% on performance. And, you know, this was my Everest. You know, this was the culmination of everything I've done as an endurance bike rider. In terms of how I was at the finish, yeah, I was absolutely exhausted. I pushed myself harder than I've ever pushed myself. It's very hard to put into words where I went mentally and physically on that journey. But I think I've recovered remarkably quickly. And that's credit to, you know, the performance team around me. I don't want to sort of contradict what some journalists have said, but I think some journalists have looked for, you know, a dead man walking. They've wanted to say that I'm a broken man. And, you know, look at me, I'm fine. For sure, I've got 2 months of winding down and recovery. But what we've proven is that physically, you can make this sustainable. I was riding my bike for 16 hours a day. Calories in, calories out. I'm the same weight as when I started.
Which is about 90 kilos, is that?
Yeah, just under.
Yeah, which is one of the remarkable aspects of it for anyone who rides a bike. Which you've talked about yourself. I mean, because you're not the build of an endurance cyclist.
No, absolutely not. And that's commented on a lot because people see me on the telly and they assume I'm, I don't know, a tour rider size, and then they meet me and I'm 6'3". And in a different life, if I'd trained, you know, from being a 15-year-old, I could be a rugby player, not an endurance cyclist. But to make it, you know, I do think that my build, ultimately, to cycle around the world at the pace of 240 miles a day is a task in never injuring, in never breaking down. It's not about your top end speed or how.
It's about robustness.
Yeah. So I always think that, you know, the practice I have over the last two decades and being a bigger build means that I'm pretty resilient to injury.
Was it, I mean, the last one you did, and I've been reminding myself of that, you know, you mentioned it's a wild man adventure, but there was a real sense of adventure. And I, reading the book especially, I learned a lot about the world from reading that book, for Iran, Pakistan, and even Australia and America. It kind of turned some of my assumptions or preconceptions on their head about, you know, where was safe and where wasn't. And there was that real sense of adventure. Did you have any of that this time, or was it just head down, you know, hours on the bike, miles on the road?
I mean, there's not a speed you can go at on the bike where you're not tuned into the world around you. So, yeah, I wasn't stopping and chatting to the locals like I was 10 years ago. You know, people are so used to traveling by flying into a place and then comparing it to home. And you talk about differences because you're just seeing two different places, one familiar, one unfamiliar. The amazing thing about riding a bicycle around the world is that you see the world by similarities because you're joining it up. You know, the cultures, the people, the places, it changes. I always think it's like seeing the world as a slideshow. Keep in mind, I just rode through for 78 days, every sunrise and every sunset. And each and every day, because of the scale of the journey, was seeing amazing change. And also so many people came out and rode with me. So I sort of had my, local tour guides explaining, you know, the bits I wasn't experiencing because I just never got off the bike. So I think I've got an amazing sense of the places I went through.
I mean, just take a step back. Tell us the route that you took this time, because it was different to last time, obviously.
Yeah, it was totally different. And I mean, even though I was going for the same record, the circumnavigation world record by bicycle, you can't really compare the two because, you know, mentally and physically, going completely alone and unsupported, and this time going with a full support crew, media team, the works, is totally different. I mean, I was basically a tour rider going 18,000 miles. If I had a puncture, you know, wheel off, wheel on, you know, race on. It was a very slick operation. The route this time went from Paris to Beijing, leg one, so through Russia, Mongolia, China. Flew down across Australia, very similar to the last time, up New Zealand. Flew up to Anchorage and cycled across to Halifax, and in the final push, the final 1,000 miles from Lisbon through Madrid and back to Paris. So the rules of the race are 18,000 miles, always in the same direction, hit antipodal points, two points on the opposite side of the planet, which are, for me, Madrid and Wellington, and always go in the same direction. So the biggest difference was leg one. So 10 years ago, I went from Paris to Calcutta. So as you mentioned before, you know, down through Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, India. I don't think that route would have been sensible now. I think it's got trickier over the last decade. I mean, it was hard enough 10 years ago when I had the levy, the Pakistani transport police escorting me around the, you know, skirting the Helmand province. And certainly with a full media team and all the, you know, all the gubbings this time, that would have been asking for trouble. The first time I cycled around the world will always have a very special place for me because it was the first time, you know, I left Europe and North America, that sort of familiar Western world, if you like. And, you know, you're just wide-eyed and naive. You know, it's very special the first time you take yourself off and just have a proper wild man adventure like that, sleeping in mosques, armed guards,
sleeping under the road in Iran. I remember you slept in
just weird and wonderful experiences. I mean, that, you know, for the last 10 years and the 130 countries I've been to and all the adventures I've been, that first one will always be very special just because of, you know, how little I knew going into it. And yeah, comparing what I've just done, I was entirely focused on performance this time. I mean, I was interested in the world around me. I was fascinated. People often ask me, oh, you know, doing what you do, would you not have a crack at the year record? And I've got amazing respect for, you know, everyone doing what they've done over the last few years, going for the Tommy Godwin record. But personally, I can't imagine anything worse than leaving my front door to ride over 200 miles every day. It's not why I ride a bike. You know, for me, it's because it can take me around the world. You know, it's still that sense of I plan it carefully, but every day is different, and it's exciting.
I mentioned that first journey, you know, it surprised me, some of the experiences you had, and you know, the friendliness in Iran, the difficulties you had in Pakistan. Sort of, I think at one point you managed to lose your police guard that you had, sleeping in a petrol station forecourt at one point in a hammock, I seem to recall. And then, of course, you were mugged in America. You were knocked off your bike there as well. You had a lot of road rage in Australia. What surprised you this time? Were there any big surprises this time?
I would say Russia was the toughest part of the ride and the part I least enjoyed, and it made me realize how little I know about Russia. I guess we know a little bit about Western Russia in terms of Moscow and St. Petersburg, but I assumed once you got across the Ural Mountains into West Siberian Plateau and, you know, further east, it would empty out. It would be a wilderness like going north in Canada. You know, far from it. It remained incredibly busy, industrial, polluted, you know, and I just realized sort of week two in Russia how little I know about this part of the world. And yeah, it was tough riding. I mean, it keep in mind, I got through Europe in 6 days from Paris to the Lithuanian-Russian border. And so I was on a bit of a high getting to Russia, and it was all pretty exciting. And then everything slowed down. I had 17 incredibly tough days on broken roads, and it was an absolute battle.
And a crash as well.
Yeah, so day 9, I mean, the day before I'd come through Moscow, I'd had a tailwind, it was a 260-mile day, the whole team were on a complete high. We just nailed the first 8 days on the road. And, you know, the big concerns on the performance side was obviously that I would injure in the first couple of weeks. You know, translating 2 years of training into the actual race around the planet, if you're going to get repetitive strain injuries, just the load of 16 hours a day on the bike, it's going to happen in the first couple of weeks. So it felt like a perfect start. And then day 9, 5 o'clock in the morning, wet roads. I pedaled over what looked like just sitting water in the very black tar, and it was a hole in the road. So the front wheel just disappeared. I hit the ground with my face and my left hand, you know, obviously trying to catch the fall. Initially, the worry was my face, because, you know, with broken tooth in my mouth and blood, you know, that's the immediate concern. But despite having wobbly teeth and having sort of chipped some teeth, that settled down relatively quickly. And as the sort of days wore on, we realized that the elbow was more of a problem. I just brushed it off thinking, oh, I've bruised my elbow a wee bit. But I fractured the radial head. So, you know, chipped the elbow. And the Russian roads are constantly bad, and you've not got a hard shoulder, and you're sort of riding incredibly defensively because of the trucks and the heavy traffic. So I nearly gave myself an injury through Russia because I was riding in such a poor way, because I was basically compensating for a fracture on my left elbow, which meant that I was putting a huge amount through my right leg, right arm, you know, the issues I gave my neck and right knee, and you know, I was just riding incredibly lopsided. I broke my right pedal after 17 days because I had a weird pedaling technique because of this hairline fracture on my left elbow. And that became the main concern. I can't tell you how relieved I was to cross into Mongolia, because the mining companies have built perfect roads through Mongolia, and suddenly I had smooth riding and I, you know, could put a bit more weight through this left arm.
That is the thing, isn't it? And I think you made this point in your first book about traveling the world by bicycle, even with a support team, it gives you a unique kind of vantage point. But also, and did you find this time as well, a unique welcome from people? People don't perceive you as a threat when you arrive by bicycle. But was that the case this time with the support team as well?
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't have any issues at all. I mean, I thought that, I mean, I've just said I didn't particularly enjoy riding through Russia, but equally I thought it would be very bureaucratic. I'd be stopped by the police all the time, and none of that. I think people were quite fascinated by me. You know, even in these parts where there's not many touring cyclists, people were just, I think, a bit confused to see somebody in an aero helmet with a visor, in a carbon race bike, you know, deep rim wheels. You know, this is not what you see in Outer Mongolia, the Gobi Desert, you know, in many of the places I went through. I probably looked like a spaceman landed. And also the time of day, you know, every day started at 4 a.m. and I was riding till 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. So I definitely got some quizzical responses from locals and truck drivers. It was fascinating across North America because the truckers definitely sussed out pretty quickly what I was doing, and then they all get on the radios to each other. And it, you know, every day it was just, you know, thumbs up, toots of the horn, you know, this camaraderie on the road from there he is and the distances he's doing. And that was quite cool because you could tell there was a community on the road who knew exactly what I was doing.
Well, anyone who's ridden a bike long distances, you know, you have to play tricks on yourself. You've got little techniques, mind games that you play with yourself. What do you use to keep yourself going when it's, you know, when you're putting in those sorts of hours, 240 miles a day?
I mean, I think people are probably expecting some, you know, golden key or great inspiration. I mean, the reality is when you're that sleep deprived, you probably go slightly into idiot mode because 5 hours a night sleep for 2.5 months, 16 hours a day on the bike, it's brutal. I mean, I'd ask anyone listening, you know, as an endurance rider, you can probably get your head around a 240 mile day with the sun shining and a bit of a tailwind. But keep in mind that
240 just, to be honest.
But 240 miles is not your best day with a tailwind and the sun shining. 240 miles is your average day. And once you finish that, you get 5 hours kip, the alarm goes off at 3:30, you're back on the bike. So it's very hard to put into words what happens day 3, 4, 5, week 3, 4, 5, 2.5 months into a journey like that. I definitely had an emotional journey that I've never experienced before. And I've been around the world top to bottom and spent the last decade. I mean, I was a 12-year-old kid who pedaled across Scotland. I've been, you know, pushing my ambitions for the last 22 years. And yet this took me to a whole new realm. I think the only trick, if there is one, is I get very good at fixating on where I'm trying to go, the finishing line. And I get very good at focusing on what's around me. And I get very good at truncating whatever's between those two points. You cannot think about the scale of the road between now and then. I'll tell you the scariest thought, and this sort of increased as the road went on, is thinking back to being at the start line. You know, I can remember getting to halfway and imagining having to do that again. And what it was like to be me in Paris with the entire world ahead of me. And it, you sort of drown in fear at the thought of it. But that's because you've done it and you would never want to do it again. But as the journey went on, you know, that's the nature of endurance. And now I've finished it. You know, there's no way I'd put myself through that again.
Were the lows this time lower than the lows the last time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, lows come in two categories, I guess. I mean, I crashed 3 times, which is not great. You know, every 3 weeks coming off my bike, I should probably be better by now. But when you have a crash or you have a serious incident like that, I mean, we wrote off one of the support vehicles in Australia. I mean, these were serious. But in moments like that, you have to act. You know, the adrenaline's pumping. It's all, you know, hands to the pump. And everyone's pretty proactive. What's probably harder to deal with is just the battle of attrition. It's just the weeks and weeks and weeks. By the time I got, so the second half of North America, leg three, when I came around the Great Lakes and back up through Ontario and Quebec and heading over to Halifax, those were probably my hardest weeks. It's the opposite of having adrenaline. You know, I'd thought all my thoughts, I'd played all my tricks. I was just 2 months in and I was absolutely finished. And yet, you know, the further you go, the more you have to lose. And the margin of error on getting around the planet in 80 days is so fine. You know, you can lose half a day incredibly easily, but it would take you an entire week or two of great riding to make that back. So, you know, I was always just never letting myself have a break at all. You know, in those 4-hour sets, it didn't matter what the conditions were. I never stopped the bike. You know, my performance team were driving along behind me, watching me closely. And they were the ones that would say, Mark, you're now dangerous. You're starting to waver on the road. You're too tired to make those decisions yourself. You're cognitively slowed. And I think only an endurance bike rider would understand where you go. And I'm too stubborn probably to say I need to stop. You know, everyone would just assume that, you know, this is my project. Mark's the boss. That couldn't happen. You know, I was just the guy on the bike. I had to completely hand over control and trust to the team around me and know that they were going to get me around the planet. So in terms of leadership, it was a really interesting conversation. And I found, don't get me wrong, it wasn't without issues because that's a real pressure cooker of a situation. But the psychological strength and support for me came from, the fact I've been doing this for 20 years and I took it to the next level here. And I think I could only do that because of the team around me.
At least you could get away from them on your bike for a lot of the day, because that's always when you're sort of cooped up with people, that can be stressful.
I mean, I think they're still sort of traumatized by for 16 hours a day watching that blinking black light, literally just as a, you know, as a follow vehicle.
Maybe
riding
the other ones that need the psychological support.
I got a message from Laura the other day there, because she was flying to Beijing to support one of her other athletes, and she said she woke up mid-flight and went to find me to make sure I was ready to, you know, get off the flight and transit on to, you know, so I think there's post-traumatic stress there.
Does the world seem smaller or bigger after doing something like that?
Yeah, kind of a bit of both. Is it allowed to be sort of ginormously tiny?
Yeah.
I mean, I've just pedaled a bike around the world in 78 days and 14 hours. So in one sense, it's a lot smaller than it used to be. We live in such a tiny island here in the UK. And, you know, you can pedal coast to coast in a day or less if you wish. So, you know, to suddenly take on these continents, which take you a fortnight or 3 weeks to pedal absolute all guns blazing across, is, you know, gives you a great sense of the geography and the scale. It's also pretty exciting when you pelt up New Zealand in 5 days. And, you know, you see that pace of change. So, yeah, a bit of both. I think the reason I'm struggling to answer the question is I don't really feel like I've stopped yet. You know, I finished 2 weeks ago and I've spent the last couple of weeks, you know, chatting to press and, you know, really reacting to everyone else's surprise. It's really interesting how everyone's reacted to this. I'm massively relieved. I'm delighted. And, you know, I'm very passionate about sharing the journey, but I'm certainly not surprised. Because at the end of the day, we did exactly what we said we were going to do. We had a very clear plan, and we did it almost within hours.
I think for anybody, cyclists or non-cyclists, it's the distance. It's the daily 240 miles. It's that people struggle to comprehend, because it seems at the very outer limits of what's actually physically possible.
Yeah, and I think I felt that before as well. The ambition to backtrack slightly. You know, I'd given up as an athlete in 2012 after I capsized trying to break the world record for rowing the Atlantic. You know, I was done. Next chapter, I thought I'll turn the camera the other way. I'll become a broadcaster. I got married. It was always about, you know, I've had great fun in my 20s trying to crack records and be an adventurer, but I'm done because I nearly died out there. And it was only through presenting the build-up to Glasgow 2014, the Commonwealth Games, and interviewing hundreds of athletes that I was inspired, but I was also really jealous. And I sat down with Nikki, my wife, after, you know, August 2014, and I said, you know, I can be a broadcaster in 5-10 years' time, but this is the only time to put all my cards on the table and try and figure out, you know, what I could be as a bike rider. And I did say to Nikki, if I'm going to come back and try and, you know, break some more records, it's got to be the world. You know, everything is small talk compared to the world in terms of endurance bike riding. So that was it, but... When I first set out 2012, 2013, I wanted to do a big training ride, something that would sort of, I guess, update my profile as a bike rider, because it had been many years, and try and figure out what was possible. And that's why I broke the Cairo to Cape Town world record, the length of Africa. And that was, I think, about as fast as I could go unsupported. So, I mean, there's not so good roads down parts of Africa, and I averaged 160 miles a day. And I took that record from 59 days down to 41. But it was after that and doing a lot of testing, putting a team around me. Everything I did for a 2-year period was seen in the press as standalone events. But for me, there was always a game plan to figure out what was possible for the world. It was all, so I didn't announce my plans to go around the world until earlier this year. Mm. It was very close to starting. But everything I've done since the Commonwealth Games was building up to it. You know, even riding the North Coast 500 nonstop. It was all part of the big game plan. And it was really only in the last 18 months that I set on the 80 days. Obviously, with my media hat on, I got the hook. But a lot of people said beforehand, why don't you just go for the current world record and then surprise people by going sub 80 days? Why stake your entire reputation and risk failure by going out there and calling the entire trip around the world in 80 days? Because if I'd come home in 82 days, I might have obliterated the current world record, but it would have been seen as a failure. But I kind of liked the risk in that. I kind of felt like, well, I kind of feel like you're never going to do better than what you set out to do. So you better be pretty clear about that. And it is so difficult to average 240 miles a day that you shouldn't even talk about anything else. Because, I mean, huge respect to Andrew Nicholson, who held the record before. His was a very different record because he did it almost completely unsupported. So I wasn't trying to beat his time. I was trying to get around the world in 80 days. So I thought, I can't make it a conversation about the world record. I have to talk about and obsess on and plan around the 80 days. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. The I guess the worry came, the big training ride was in April this year, where I did a 3,000 miler around the coastline of Britain, London to London, and it took 14 and a half days. I averaged 225 miles a day, and I finished with a hamstring injury. So I was worried. You know, it was a quasi-success because we learned a ton. It helped us select the team. We knew how to be more efficient in terms of the support, but I hadn't proven the concept. I hadn't proven that I could sustainably ride 240 miles a day. You know, I was injured after 2 weeks. Even some of my close team have admitted since, they didn't before, but I've admitted since I've finished that they were more worried, on the start line in Paris, they were more worried about failure than excited by success. But I sensed that. You know, I felt very alone with the ambition. I had wonderful team around me, and even my, you know, my close family. They didn't question me to my face, but I could tell by their body language. I could tell by the mood in camp that everyone felt like we'd bitten off quite a lot, and there was just no margin for error. So I felt very alone with that. You know, can I do this? And it was wonderful to get to about a third of the way around the world and go, right, you know, we've proven that this is possible. It is sustainable. You can't, we just need to keep doing what we're doing. But I didn't feel, you know, after about a third of the way, I felt, well, nobody's going to turn around and say, well, that's utterly ridiculous. Even if I can't complete the world in 80 days, you know, I've put it out there for other people to attempt now. And that's definitely moved the goalpost.
It certainly has. I mean, the last time you did it, it did inspire a lot of people to go for the record. Do you think other people will... Well, do you think people will try to beat this?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I'd be the first to offer support and, you know, mentor anyone that wants to give the record a crack. That's what records are for. You know, it's not for anyone to try and hold on to. The challenge now with the circumnavigation world record, you know, 10 years ago, I basically left university as a you know, a keen endurance bike rider, got some sponsorship and off I went. Now... it's not just the ability to be a very strong and resilient endurance bike rider, but you need to be able to put a professional team around you, you know, have the support to pull off something on this scale. If you're interested in creating a media story around it, the costs are going to be a lot greater. I mean, it was over 10 times the cost now than it was 10 years ago. So it's really a professional record now, whereas 10 years ago, it was definitely in the realms of the touring cyclist and the amateur. So I guess the barrier to entry is higher than it used to be. You know, being a good bike rider is just the starting point now.
You always put a lot of emphasis on the ambition that you set, the focus that you have, the fact that you set these goals and then just go about them with this single-minded determination. Do you acknowledge a talent as well? Because especially with this one and the physical feat of riding that distance every day, acknowledge that you have a talent for this that certainly not everybody has?
I mean, I would definitely acknowledge, because so many people join me on the route, that what I have practiced over the last, you know, 20 years, but certainly the last 10, allows me to do what I do. You know, as an ultra endurance athlete, you know, everything from my metabolism to, you know, my muscle makeup to, you know, the psychology, you know, everything is adapted to be able to ride these huge miles. You know, being joined by Cy Richardson on day one, an ex-pro who, you know, certainly can ride a bike brilliantly. You know, after one day, that was absolutely enough. And I could tell, you know, that ability to wake up 5 hours later and repeat for 78 days is something that comes out of practice as opposed to natural talent. But the flip side of that is I do train with people all the time who are, in a classic sense of the word, faster, in one sense, fitter bike riders. And so I don't class myself, you know, even amongst friends, as the best bike rider. I've just honed my talent to be able to ride the big distances. I mean, the X factor, that you might have the best team around you, have trained and be as resilient as you wish, but the X factor to be able to ride around the world in 80 days is your ability to suffer. You really need to be able to suffer. And I just, you know, I think a lot of bike riders just wouldn't want to put themselves through that. So I would never pretend to be able to enter a pro race and, you know, compete with the best. I might happily sit in the peloton. But, you know, to be able to do what I've done and, you know, average 240 miles a day is really just, you know, never giving up. It hurts like hell. And I mean, it's not really your muscles, because once you're fit enough, you know, my legs are absolutely fine. You know, it's the it's your neck from the tri-bar position. It's the, you know, the deep calluses in the hands. It's the, when you're underneath the cleats, it feels like you're riding on hot coals. You know, the pressure sores there. Saddle sores, let's not talk about them. You know, it's the conditioning to be able to do this day in, day out, and just suffer on the bike. And then that sort of raises the inevitable question, well, why do you do it if it's so miserable? And I think that only an endurance bike rider would understand.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, were there moments that you enjoyed, that you had moments of, I don't know, that euphoric feeling that we all have sometimes riding a bike? Did you have many of those moments?
It's wonderful. It's indescribably brilliant. People often, you know, I did two video diaries a day at sort of 3:40 in the morning, and then when I got off the bike, and people often said I looked fresher and better at half past 10 at night after ridden 250 miles than I did in the morning. That's because you feel shocking when you wake up at 3:30 and you've got to get on your bike. But there's a wonderful, wonderful feeling from having put an epic day behind you, and you know, the excitement of having covered the miles and ticked off another day on the record, and just some magical moments, you know, riding through the Gobi Desert with wild horses galloping along beside you, or climbing up through the Southern Alps in New Zealand, through Queenstown and you know, with Snow Peak Mountains around you, ice on your jacket. I mean, it's gritty stuff. It's definitely type 2 fun, but it's amazing. You know, it's, you do pinch yourself and say, this is my job and this is my dream. You know, this is something I've built towards. And then I look behind me in the follow vehicle and I can see Laura and Mike and the whole performance team, you know, as for some reason, you know, obsessed and making my dream a reality. It's amazing to have other people so invested in your simple idea to get around the planet in 80 days. So yeah, I loved it, but I suffered more than I'd ever want to suffer again.
So what now then? Is that it?
Somebody asked me that on the finishing line.
What's next?
I thought it would be such a wonderful moment to announce your next expedition. Yeah, good idea. Yeah,
I've been thinking about it the last 7 to 8 days.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of, yeah, it's all too fresh. I finished 2 weeks ago. I do feel like that's sort of the end of a big chapter. I can't think how to trump that as a bike rider in terms of an endurance bike rider. I'll always need to get my fix. I can't wait to, you know, I'm already back on the bike training down. I've got to. But I don't think I'm going to try and, you know, beat that in terms of profile or distance or anything. I think I'll do what I said I would do before and turn the camera the other way and capture other stories and go on slower adventures. And, you know, my passion is to keep ploughing my own furrow, you know, lead an adventurous life. I've got a beautiful young family. I've got 2 daughters, and spend a bit more time with them. I mean, I think any athlete will reflect, I've had to be pretty selfish over the last couple of years to have pulled off what I've done. And Nikki, my wife, and Una, my mum, have been incredibly supportive. But, you know, I definitely owe them some more time.
This has been a pilot episode of the Cycling Podcast Brevet. We hope you enjoyed it. Please let us know if you have any feedback, or tell us whether you'd like to hear more. Perhaps you have some ideas of your own for some future episodes. You can contact us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast. We're also on Facebook, and our email address is contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
The Cycling Podcast Brevet. Tales from the world of endurance and ultra endurance riding.